elections as soon as possible, and the president should remove his military uniform. A previous decision, we've made it clear that these emergency measures were, would undermine democracy. Having said that, I did remind the prime minister that President Musharraf has been a strong fighter against extremists and radicals, that he understands the dangers posed by radicals. After all, they tried to kill him 3 or 4 times, and our hope is that he will restore democracy as quickly as possible.
That's the latest from President George W. Bush on the situation in Pakistan. Of course, you've been reading about this in the newspaper, seeing it on television, hearing about it on the radio, that the President Musharraf of Pakistan has imposed, in essence, martial law. He's trying to keep his own citizens in order. A lot of it has to do with radical extremist Islam, as the president was describing there. But it's a tense situation. Pakistan is also a nuclear power, or at least a burgeoning one, and has never had great relations with its neighbors. So here is an ally of sorts that is suffering from no small amount of internal unrest. And what role does Islam play in all of this? We're going to talk about that for the first half hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live this Tuesday, the 6th of November. Questions or comments on Pakistan? We're going to be talking with Amir Khan in just a moment. He's a pastor and a native of Pakistan, about the situation there. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Or you can email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. After our short conversation with Pastor Khan, we'll be talking with Deirdre Sesgreen. She is a reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and author of a story, you probably saw it today, titled Joyce Meyer Ministries is Target of GOP Senators Probe. We'll talk about that front page story with her for about 10 minutes after the bottom of the hour, and then starting at about 3:40, Jennifer Law will join us to talk about a New Jersey vote on funding embryonic stem cell research. She's from the Center for Bioethics and Culture. Coming up at 4 o'clock, some audio open lines. Richard Cizik of the National Association of Evangelicals wants the issue of climate change to be on par with other issues that evangelicals concern themselves with in the political realm. We'll hear what he has to say. Then at 5 o'clock, we'll review an All Saints Day sermon preached by Pastor Joe Fisher of Pilgrim Lutheran Church in West Bend, Wisconsin. That's the lineup for today. Our call-in numbers again, 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. Before we welcome Pastor Khan to the microphone, let's hear this story that brings us the latest of the situation in Pakistan.
More violence on the streets of Pakistan as police beat, kicked, and arrested lawyers outside courthouses in Lahore, Islamabad, and other cities. The country's judicial system is now on lockdown, with 1 in 4 lawyers in custody or detained in their homes, and no courts open to free them. There's no word when the state of emergency will be lifted. The Pakistani cabinet is meeting today to discuss when elections will be held.
I can assure you there will be harmony. There will be harmony. Confidence will come back into government, into law enforcement agencies.
A spokesperson for former Prime Minister and political rival Benazir Bhutto called President Pervez Musharraf's declaration an act of terror. Critics say he's desperate for power.
I think that what Musharraf didn't sort of plan was what would be the follow-up from the state of emergency. And he's now sort of waiting and seeing what will happen in the streets, how the politicians will react.
President Bush condemned Musharraf's actions, but emphasized he remains an ally.
At the same time, we want to continue working with him to fight these terrorists and extremists.
For now, holding cells across Pakistan are bursting with political prisoners, and the world watches to see what happens next. Emily Chang, CNN, London.
There's the story. Pastor Amir Khan joins us for the next few minutes of the program. Pastor Khan is a native of Pakistan, and he's also a missionary for Pablo, People of the Book Lutheran Outreach. Pastor Khan, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hello.
Pastor, were you surprised when to hear about Musharraf's latest actions and the basically the military takeover of Pakistan?
No, actually I was not, because it was expected that he should be doing something. And I think the step which he took, it was very necessary to take.
Can you make sense of what's happening here from the Western press's reporting? we hear about lawyers protesting in the streets and jails being filled with lawyers. They said a fair percentage of them are actually in prison, at least temporarily. What's going on?
Yeah, the thing is that most of these attorneys and lawyers, and many of them have a strong ties with Osama bin Laden's organization. And there are so many businessmen also involved because President Musharraf has a strong enemy within the Pakistani system. So I think it was necessary what he's doing, because Western people doesn't know, you know, they're sitting in their home and doesn't know what's going on in Pakistan.
What exactly was going on in Pakistan that, in your mind, made it necessary for President Musharraf to crack down in this fashion?
You see, what happened first was the Red Mosque in Islamabad when the terrorists took over. And when they, the security forces arrested those 13 terrorists, who some of them are belong to some other countries, but the High Court actually came in and 2 weeks back, you know, released them and acquitted them from all the charges. So that was one of the biggest thing, you know. This the Chief Justice is also related to some of those people who are very close to Osama bin Laden.
So how has terrorist activity and Islamist activity taken such a strong foothold in Pakistan?
It was started by General Zia-ul-Haq when he created those Talibans, you know, to fight back. So all those organizations were, you know, raising funds and doing, because it's very essential for a Muslim to, you know, raise jihad, you know, against the people. So this is how they got favor now, and the government was giving favor at that time. Then later Nawaz Sharif came also, he was also helping those terrorist organizations. So this is how they got a strong hold in Pakistan.
Recently, the former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, who'd been living essentially in exile for a long time, attempted to return to Pakistan and found it very difficult to do that. What did that mean, her attempt to return to Pakistan?
Actually, she might have gone over there by the influence of the Western countries, because one of the thing is that personally I feel Benazir is a good person, I mean very good intelligent person to handle Pakistan, but most of her party members are very corrupt, very, very corrupt. So probably she might try now to, you know, get some chance with the Pervez Musharraf.
What is the issue that we constantly hear about? I heard Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and then the President most recently, say that President Musharraf needs to take off his military uniform. What's the symbolism involved there, Pastor Khan?
You see, the thing is that according to the Pakistani Constitution of 1973, the army cannot take over the government. But in 1979, Zia-ul-Haq took over and he made some changes in the constitution. So the thing is, they did try a civilian president also in Pakistan, but it was a disaster because both of these parties are very corrupt, Muslim League and People's Party. And these are the major parties, you know. And to hold both the position, you know, it's unconstitutional. But since 1979, our constitution never been reinstated.
So
when they are forcing, you know, that he should leave one of the posts, if he becomes the president, then he cannot have a control on the army. Because he has a fear, because there are some elements of Osama bin Laden in the army also.
What sort of solution do you anticipate for this? Of course, there's the call for elections. We heard in the piece from CNN just a moment ago. Mm-hmm. The members of the parliament are trying to assure the public in Pakistan that there will be a restitution of order, and that there will be elections, and that there will be a resolution. Do you think that's really possible, Pastor?
I think it is too early to say Musharraf should not take a step to go for election. Western people doesn't know. Let Musharraf clean all these problems in Pakistan. Unless and until he clean, you know, all those terrorist organizations and all the madrasa systems and the mosques, nothing is going to change. And if they promise an early election, I think that will be another disaster.
We're talking to Pastor Amir Khan. He's a native of Pakistan, about the unrest in Pakistan recently. He's also a missionary for Pablo, People of the Book Lutheran Outreach. For the next 10 minutes of the program, I'm Todd Wilkin. You can join us with questions or comments, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Okay, is the danger of early elections or premature elections in Pakistan that the electorate would actually make matters worse by increasing the representation of the Islamists there in Pakistan?
Yeah, I think you're right in one sense that there are chances for those people because they were ruling two of the province and they made a lot of changes in the electoral system over there. They will have many, many fake voters to come. And the second biggest problem is that if they reinstate the constitution right now, and Chaudhry, the Chief Justice Iftikhar Ahmed, he's also supported by many of those fundamentalist organizations of Pakistan. So again, the mess will be again there.
You mentioned before the mosques. What role are the mosques and the clerics in those Islamic centers of worship playing in the unrest and playing in the Islamist movement?
You see, this is a very big question to answer. The thing is that it's all from Saudi Arabia, and I strongly believe that the all mess around the world is by the Saudis. These mosques mostly are funded by Saudi people in Pakistan, and they are actually creating these Taliban kind of, people to take over the West in future. So Saudi is actually playing in the both sides,
Do you believe that Osama bin Laden is in Pakistan? You've mentioned him several times already.
Yeah, actually, he right now might be hiding in some of the caves, but I think he's there. He has no other way to go. He must be in Waziristan or some frontier part of Kashmir, occupied Kashmir. That's where actually these extremist people are holding. He could be in Charsada, another Pakhtun area, because Pakhtuns have no sympathy with the government, but they support him.
Is President Musharraf willing to look for and find Osama bin Laden?
I think he will not, because he will face a lot of pressure from the army.
What's the connection between the army there in Pakistan and Osama bin Laden?
You see, General Zial Haq, who killed Bhutto in 1979 and took over, the power, he is the one who created all this mess. And Army ISI was involved for a long, long time. General Hamid Gul was in charge, and he's the one who did it. And their motto is to destroy America. Sooner or later, their target is by 2024. So they're pretty much, so that's why, if Musharraf has no fear from the other army officers, he could have gone earlier after Osama bin Laden and finished him.
And be clear, if you would, what is the Saudi connection? You mentioned that you believe the Saudis are funding the mosques and some of the Taliban-like activity. What do you think the connection is there?
Oh, big, big. And they have so many fundamentalist organizations funded by them. And a lot of Saudis are, doing, madrasa schools over there.
Is there any way to, for Musharraf to realistically cut the connection between Saudi money and what's going on in his country, Saudi money and its apparent alliance with the ends or at least the goals of Osama bin Laden?
Yeah, Pervez Musharraf can do if they have a financial needs to be met by the Western countries. Otherwise, it will not, because Saudi is contributing a lot of money towards Pakistani economy. So you can imagine that,
So then when you hear President Bush call for elections, call for a restitution of the Constitution there, and call for President Musharraf to remove his military uniform and act as a civilian leader in Pakistan, what's your general impression, Pastor Khan?
I think that will give a negative picture of Pervez Musharraf, that West is not behind him, and it will make other organization more strong. I think so. They should say to him that we are behind you. I think that you have only one partner left in this war against the terrorism, and that is Musharraf. Maybe the Benazir could do a little bit, but Musharraf, if Musharraf is there, he can really work hard if the West is behind him.
Can he survive if he is viewed by the Islamists in his country as a puppet of the United States?
That's the biggest problem, you know. The problem in Pakistan is the people feel that America will come and then leave, you know. If America is there and say, no matter what happens, I'm staying with them and helping the government, I think people will develop a long relationship.
What's the state of Christianity in Pakistan, Pastor Khan?
Well, during this period of Musharraf, Christians are little, you know, free. Free means they are living a peaceful life, but still there are a lot of persecution. Some of my relatives got killed, and that's going on, but it's relatively better than previous administration.
And how much does the nuclear issue play in this whole Pakistani situation, given that Pakistan does have the bomb?
Well, nuclear facilities were funded by the Saudis a long time back during the Bhutto's time. And mostly this facility worked for Saudi Arabia, and nobody is going to shut down. And they have a lot of money, but that's what actually the politicians use. You know, this is an Islamic bomb, and we can use against anyone. So I think it's scary also.
On the other side, there's India. It's long-running dispute. You mentioned the disputed territory around Kashmir with Pakistan. Do you expect India to take advantage of the unrest and the apparent precarious situation of Musharraf?
No. India will not do that.
Why not?
The present government is very sensible. Congress is good government, and especially the Sonia Gandhi and all those. I don't think so. They will jump in to do anything.
How much longer can it go on there in Pakistan, Pastor Khan, where apparently, at least according to the press reports, the prisons are full, the protests continue, and it seems to be a picture of violence?
You see, it's not. The thing over here is that if I put a black coat, you know, and a white shirt and become attorney, and then I see, you know, everything is in my hand, you know, when you see the media and, you know, exploring all those things. These are people underground, you know, forces for Osama bin Laden, you know, destroying Pakistan. The people who are fighting for the constitution, how much they abuse the constitution when most of these people were in power.
Is there a chance that what happened in Iran in the past might transpire in Pakistan, where the secularists and the academics sided with the Islamist fundamentalists?
I think you're right. Thinking about that possibility, that's where Pakistan is going right now, because Iran is funding money, Saudi is funding money, so both you know, going actually towards that, you know, direction. If Musharraf gone and Benazir is unable to make the government, then the third party is Islamic.
When we talked to you last time, I believe, you mentioned that in the days when Saddam Hussein still held power in Iraq, he was, in a sense, a control on the Saudi influence and the Iranian influence in Pakistan. Talk about that briefly, if you would.
Yeah, what I was mentioning is that rather than going after him, what I felt is that if you make him a friend and use against Saudi and Iran, that would have been more better, because It is he was a bad man. There is no, absolutely no doubt. But the Saudis and Iranians are much more bad, countries than Iraq. So I think if they would have gone other way, the situation would have been very different now.
What do the Islamists want for the future of Pakistan?
Well, the Islamists very clearly say this is what the Saudis need. The Saudis want to have a Wahhabi-run government in Pakistan. So they can use a nuclear weapon. They will bring the American economy down. And then finally they can take over Israel. Because they have to take over there in order to bring a Muslim domain. So there are only two countries in front of that target. One is Israel, another is America. And according to their Sharia law, according to history, the Mahdi will not come unless and until there is a whole Islamic domain on the world.
So you're talking there about the so-called final imam or the 13th imam that they believe will come?
That's what they are working for now. So Iranian think that the imam will come from them, and the Muslims, Sunnis and Wahhabis think from them.
You mentioned, with only a minute here, you mentioned before the date 2024.
Yeah.
Why is that significant, Pastor Khan?
In 1974, they set a target to destroy the West, bring it on knees, and then the government, Saudis, will take over the world by their wealth. So that's a pretty much, it was decided in Pakistan, and that's why these all organizations are working to go towards that to achieve by 2024.
Pastor Amir Khan is a native of Pakistan, a missionary for Pablo, People of the Book Lutheran Outreach. Pastor Khan, thank you for your time again.
My pleasure.
You can find out more about Pablo at pablo.org. It's P-O-B-L-O.org. P-O-B-L-O.org. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with a reporter from the St. Louis Dispatch who has authored the story, front page story, on Joyce Meyer Ministries and a new senator's probe. We'll be talking about that with the reporter, and then we'll round off this first hour of Issues Etc. discussing the New Jersey vote on funding stem cell research with Jennifer Law of the Center for Bioethics and Culture. A little bit of audio open lines follows that, and a sermon review in the last part of a All Saints Day sermon by Joe Fisher of Pilgrim Lutheran Church in West Bend, Wisconsin. Issues Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Concordia University St. Louis Center, where classes meet one night a week for your convenience. Finish up that associate's, bachelor's, or master's of business administration degree at your convenience at Concordia University St. Louis Center. Find out more about them by giving them a call, 314-984-8840, 314-984-8840, or visit the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org. Professional education with a personal touch, Concordia University, St. Louis Center. When we come back, we're going to talk about a new informal probe, a informal investigation opened by a senator of, among other things, Joyce Meyer Ministries. Stay with us.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Here's a message I received from Frank in Las Vegas. He says, "Dear Chuck, I felt it would perhaps be appropriate for me to send this message to you. Earlier this morning, I phoned into KFUO in response to an interesting conversation between yourself and Pastor Michael Walder. The subject was forgiveness and the Lord's Supper. I attempted to make the point that the tremendous broadcasting of KFUO has made me personally aware of the radicalness of the Christian message. Thanks, Frank, for writing. And you can contact me, too. My email address is crathert@kfuo.org.
Underwriting on AM 850 KFUO provided by Reliable Heating and Cooling. Christian people who understand the value of bringing you God's Word on the radio. The folks at Reliable also know how important it is to have your furnace checked before winter. An inefficient or deteriorating heat exchanger costs you needless expense and could be dangerous. A preseason inspection from Reliable is convenient, affordable, and gives you peace of mind. Reliable Heating and Cooling, supporting the broadcast ministry of AM 850 KFUO.
A new movie emphasizes the importance of life. This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Hollywood can make a significant impact on society, even affecting our national attitude. The producers of a movie called Bella, in large market theaters since the end of August, hope to enhance our views on the sanctity of human life. Bella is the story of a star Mexican soccer player who lives a life of the rich and famous. But all that changes when he accidentally kills a little girl in a car crash. The devastating impact of the event helps the sports star understand the value of human life and leads him to rethink his own.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org. That's sba-list.org.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, where values thrive, and online at thrivent.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Last month, Pope Benedict named 81-year-old Emmanuel Delli a cardinal in the Roman Catholic Church. Now that wouldn't be worth a second thought, except that Cardinal Delli lives in Baghdad. He's been in Iraq all his life, except when he was studying in Europe, earning doctorates in theology and canon law. This lifelong Christian, there are about 500,000 in Iraq, 1 million fewer than when Saddam Hussein was in power, this lifelong Christian is understandably attuned to ecumenical relations. He has met with Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki and with the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. Says Cardinal Delli, Christians and Muslims have lived together here for 1,400 years. We have much in common. In Iraq, the Christian house is next to the Muslim house. We Americans have lived in a Christian-dominated culture for so long that we're not sure how to react to the growing presence of non-Christians in our country. Where can we find common ground for the common good? The Christian house is next to the Muslim house, the cardinal says. Each has his own religion. Each defends his own home. Each defends his religion. Your faith is for God. The country is for everyone. Is the way to relate to non-Christians in our communities to focus on our shared citizenship, not our divided faith?
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, online at thrivent.com. We do more than work. We work with a purpose.
I mean, to be honest with you, when the stories first came out, I was absolutely just flabbergasted and appalled because they said that we were possibly under an IRS investigation, and that's just totally not true. I've never heard anything from the IRS, never have been challenged by the IRS in any way, shape, or form. And the thing that's a shame about that kind of stuff is when, you know, even though they say possibly, you know, they cover themselves by not making direct statements, but it still appears to everybody else like, you know, you may be doing something wrong.
That's from an interview that we did with Joyce Meyer back in 2005. She was talking there about a 2003 St. Louis Post-Dispatch series into the finances of Joyce Meyer Ministries, of course, big Fenton-based televangelist organization. You might have seen the headline in the newspaper today, Joyce Meyer Ministries is target of GOP senators probe. We're going to be talking with the author of that front page story for the next few minutes of Issues, etc. And of course, at the time, in that 2005 interview that we did with Joyce Meyer, she said there was really nothing to any of the allegations and the IRS was never involved. Well, at least according to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch story, the IRS actually, and this is according to the lawyers for Joyce Meyer Ministry, the IRS actually did look into some of their finances. We'll see what's going on and what the new call for financial transparency, let's call it that, on the part of Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa is really all about. Deirdre Schesgreen is a reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and author of this story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch front page. Deirdre, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you so much for having me.
What exactly is Senator Grassley calling for when he's looking into these televangelist ministries?
He's calling for an accounting of their internal financial dealings. Basically, he's asked for a wide range of information about their compensation, their housing allowances, gifts, credit card statements, pretty broad range of data that he's seeking.
What we hear from these ministries, and I'm talking here in particular now about Joyce Myers, is that, hey, we're very transparent. Our books are open for anyone to see. We use our money wisely, the donors' money wisely, those kind of things. And then on the other side, we hear people saying, but we don't know what people make. We don't know people how it's being spent. What? How is the discrepancy here reconciled?
Well, these groups are tax-exempt under the law. They're churches, and therefore they are not required to pay taxes, and they also do not have to file any public documents that people can review. They do post on their website, some of them, and Joyce Meyer Ministries included, some internal financial documents that show, for example, how much revenue they get and what they spend some of their money on and what kinds of programs they support. So there's some information available, but it's all voluntarily provided by the ministers.
So when the term transparency comes up from organizations like Joyce Meyer Ministries, to be fair, they're really defining that term to the degree they want it to be transparent.
Right. I mean, she's providing what she wants to provide. She doesn't list in that document, for example, her own salary. She doesn't list her husband's salary. She doesn't say, you know, what kinds of personal expenses the ministry might cover for her. That kind of information is not available.
What's the bottom line concern for Senator Grassley at this point?
Well, he wants to know whether some of these ministries are complying with the law, the law requires that tax-exempt groups, the leaders of those groups cannot dip into the organization's accounts for their own personal use, and expenses of the organizations have to further the cause of that entity. So he wants to make sure that that law is being followed. And he also is looking at a broader question, which is the law good enough? Perhaps, you know, they are following the law, but the law is too vague. And one of the things his staff has said in sort of a background memo on this whole issue is that this information might show that everything the ministers are doing is perfectly legal, but could shock the conscience and therefore highlight shortcomings in the law.
So he has more than one concern here. He has concerns about whether or not expenses are legitimate toward the goals of the stated goals of the ministry, but
right.
Also whether or not the laws that regulate these kind of things, in particular tax-exempt status, are robust enough and meet kind of a reasonable standard of definitions there.
That's absolutely right. I mean, his quote about this was that, you know, he's worried that there are some generous salaries and housing allowances, and that some of these ministers have private jets and Rolls Royces. He doesn't want to conclude there's a problem, but he says he has an obligation to taxpayers and people who donate their money to find out more.
In particular, as listed in the story today in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, taken from the Grassley letter, are things like a $23,000 marble-topped commode, $30,000 conference table, and an $11,000 French clock.
Right.
Is the basic issue here, do these expenses further the stated goals of your ministries?
Yes. His question was, what is the tax-exempt purpose of those items? You know, why does the ministry need that to further its stated mission?
What kind of a threshold does Joyce Meyer Ministries have to meet in answering that question? I mean, do they have to be able to show that an $11,000 clock is somehow necessary in their facilities for them to do the job they claim to be doing?
Well, that's, I think, a question that Senator Grassley will have to address. I mean, they will provide whatever information they want to, and then he can decide whether, you know, it's satisfactory or not.
Do you expect Senator Grassley to seek the backing of the chairman of his committee in procuring a subpoena, if necessary, against the ministries that he's contacted?
There was no talk of issuing subpoenas yesterday when Senator Grassley issued this information. He said his staff said they expect full cooperation without such a move, and that it would, I got the sense that it would be fairly rare for them to have to take that step.
What have you heard, if anything, from Joyce Meyer Ministries?
They have said that they operate, you know, with excellence and integrity, to quote their lawyer, and that they've gone above and beyond the level of accountability. They also said that they recently were the subject of an IRS inquiry and that the IRS determined that they continue to qualify for tax-exempt status. So they say that they will, you know, that any inquiry will show that they conduct themselves in adherence with the law.
Do you know anything more about that IRS inquiry?
You know, I do not. All I know is what was what came to me yesterday in the form of a statement from the Joyce Meyer Ministries from their lawyer, and it said that they were the subject of an IRS inquiry in which the IRS asked for information for the years 2004 to 2006. And that they got a letter in October of 2007 from the IRS saying that they continue to qualify for the tax exemption.
Do you think that it's the intention of Senator Grassley to have these very large and very lucrative television ministries be treated like the billion-dollar industry, multi-billion-dollar industry that they now are? With the same kind of transparency that any big industry would have to show before the law.
Right. I don't want to speak for Senator Grassley and say that that's his intention. I think he wants to probe that question further. That's my sense. But you know, and whether he will then, you know, take the information he gets and decide that legislation is needed to require more transparency and more regulation, I think is something that we'll know in a month or so when the ministries are all supposed to respond to this request for data.
Of the December 6th deadline is what you're talking about there.
Right.
If everybody complies, what do you expect to happen next, Deirdre?
Well, I'm sure that Senator Grassley's staff will have a lot of work to do because they've requested so much information that I imagine it will take them quite a while to pour through it all. And then they may very well have hearings that will shed additional light on that and make some of those documents public and take it from there.
And then finally, why was Joyce Meyer Ministries included in the six that were the focus of Senator Grassley's letter?
Well, Grassley said in a statement yesterday that he was following up on complaints from the public and from news coverage on practices at six ministries. The Post-Dispatch did a series in 2003 that detailed some of the practices of Joyce Meyer Ministries, and so I think he may well have seen that and acted because of that.
Deirdre Shesgreen is a reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, author of the story in today's Post, titled Joyce Meyer Ministries is a Target of GOP Senators' Probe. You can read her story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on the web, stltoday.com, stltoday.com. Thanks for being our guest, Deirdre.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, there's a vote in New Jersey today. I talked a bit about it yesterday on the issue of stem cell research. It's one of many that we've seen nationwide, state by state, grappling with the idea of whether or not each state ought to be funding stem cell research and embryonic stem cell research. The dollar amounts are usually pretty high. California had a bill some time back that would fund embryonic stem cell research to the tune of $3 billion, and the price tag has apparently gone up to $6 billion in some estimates. So we're going to hear this story and then be talking with Jennifer Lall of the Center for Bioethics and Culture about New Jersey's vote on funding stem cell research. This is from National Public Radio.
Wise Young is a physician and researcher at Rutgers University who's been a fierce advocate for stem cell research for several years. At a sparkling new lab on the campus, he transplants healthy embryonic stem cells into rats with spinal cord injuries.
Let me see. I think this is a rat that's walking. So there are many therapies that are making animals walk. We need to translate some of these things to humans.
Embryonic stem cells can turn into every kind of cell in the body. That is what gives them such therapeutic promise, but also makes them controversial because the very earliest stage of a human embryo is destroyed to harvest the cells. The embryos usually come from women undergoing in vitro fertilization. While opponents say these frozen embryos should be saved and adopted, Young says there's been very little demand and the majority are never used.
Very few people know that every time an in vitro fertilization procedure occurs, they have an excess of eggs, thousands of them. And what is the choice? The choice is putting them down the drain, which is the typical way that these things are being thrown out, versus taking the cells and using them to save lives.
There's widespread support for stem cell research in New Jersey. Even 48% of evangelicals and Catholics support the ballot question, according to a recent poll. That might be why the lawn signs opposing it don't even mention stem cells. Instead, they warn against a looming hike in property taxes. Marie Tacey of New Jersey Right to Life says people don't need to be against abortion to oppose the ballot question.
This is research gone amok. I think a case can also be made that it's immoral to force taxpayers to pay for something that's going to raise their property taxes and not disclose that to the voters.
Like a red flag to a bull, any mention of raising property taxes is all it takes to strike fear in many a New Jersey voter. The state has the highest taxes in the nation, and although stem cell funding would only cost pennies per resident, it's a potent argument that fits on a bumper sticker. But even the most ardent supporters of stem cell research have mixed feelings about state funding. Sean Tipton of the Coalition for the Advancement of Medical Research says federal funding is more efficient and produces better results.
The downside is for scientists, they want to be able to do their work and do it with as little political interference as possible and not have to figure out, oh, I can work with this scientist because they are in California, but I can't work with this other one because they're working out of Michigan. So, you know, I think scientists want to work with and collaborate with the best scientists from around the world.
Wise Young at Rutgers agrees that federal funding would be better, but he doesn't think New Jersey should wait for the political tide to turn. If the ballot question passes, he says, the state will become a major player and be able to recruit top scientists. If there comes a day when the federal government funds stem cell research, Young says New Jersey's laboratories will be up and running and ready to put that money to immediate use. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Solomon in South Orange, New Jersey.
There's a story from National Public Radio. Jennifer Lahl joins us for the remainder of this hour to talk about the New Jersey vote on funding stem cell research. She's founder and national director for the Center for Bioethics and Culture. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thank you for having me again.
I got to know, what do you think of the angle of the opponents of the measure there in New Jersey to hit the property tax issue instead of the life issue on this to stir up some opposition to the proposed funding?
Well, I guess it just goes to show how little voters pay attention that everybody has to pull out all these, you know, fear tactics. I would just, unfortunately, it's almost end of business day in New Jersey, and I'm out in California. You know, why don't all of them American voters go to Google and type in cures from embryonic stem cell research, and you'll find that there's none. And that even the supporters of embryonic stem cell research will say, if cures ever come, it may be 10 or 20 years from now. So I get crazy when I hear things like, you know, spare embryos are just going to be thrown down the drain and we've got rats up and walking. You know, New Jersey voters use Google. That's why God gave us Google.
I do want you to respond in a full way to the assertion that was made there by that research who, and it should be pointed out that these researchers have a financial interest in New Jersey there in the funding as well as a political interest. But this researcher at the beginning of the story who said, your choice is simple. You either put the spare embryos down the drain and dispose of them, or you use them to save lives. How do you respond to that?
It's just, again, more fear-mongering. I mean, I just get, you know me, I get hot under the collar because it's just lies, lies, and more lies. I mean, it's absolutely absurd because we know, if we, again, go to Google, that adult stem cell research is treating patients, not helping rats walk a little tightrope, but really helping patients. It's $450 million that New Jersey voters are being asked to flush down the drain. Not embryos. Their tax dollars are going to be flushed down the drain. I understand they even broke ground, I think, last week with the new Stem Cell Institute, which is just so arrogant that before it's even gone to the voters, they're already breaking, you know, having their groundbreaking ceremonies. And again, they scare New Jersey voters into thinking we're going to lose our scientific edge. We're not going to be able to attract the best and most talented of scientific researchers. What does that say to the scientist who's busy doing adult stem cell research, and their research is right now helping patients? You know, do we not, you know, applaud their efforts for helping cure sick people?
So your case here is that this is a $450 million boondoggle.
Boondoggle, sinkhole, big black sucking sound. I mean, I think of Ross Perot. It's a big sucking sound.
What's the ethical case against state funding for embryonic stem cell research in New Jersey or any other state?
I'm sorry, what's the ethical case against embryonic stem cell research?
Yes.
Well, certainly for those of us who agree that even the embryo is human life, I mean, we oppose it on the ethical, moral grounds that it requires the destruction of embryos, of human life for research. I mean, it's also an ethical issue when you're wasting taxpayer dollars and asking taxpayers to fund hyped-up research that may never, ever benefit anybody. And then it's unethical to say, and oh, by the way, New Jersey citizens, this is going to save us money.
Let's talk with Jeff, who's calling from South Jersey. Jeff, thanks for listening out there in Jersey, and welcome to Issues
Etc. Hi, how you doing? Yeah, I'm calling from. I work in Valley Forge. That's where I'm calling from. But I live in South Jersey. I have not heard anything about this effort. I mean, it's completely under the radar. And I know we're kind of New Jersey is the nanny state, so we're under a lot of. We have a lot of spending in the governmental level, and we're under a lot of taxes, high taxes. And so I just wanted to just call and say I'm not seeing any media about this, nothing in the news media, nothing advertising-wise. It's just kind of completely under the radar. I live in the Philadelphia area. New Jersey is hard because you have to do New York media for North Jersey and Philadelphia media for South Jersey. There's no real, like, New Jersey way to just reach all New Jerseyans.
So I've heard, Jeff. Thank you very much, and thanks for listening. What do you make of that, Jennifer?
Well, I'm not sure if he said he's not heard any media for the proposition or against the proposition.
It sounds like none at all, really.
I mean, I kind of wonder where he's living. I mean, I'm out in California, and I've heard about it, and I'm not, voting in New Jersey today. I mean, I'm not saying that he hasn't, that he hasn't heard it. I acknowledge that he's said he hasn't heard it, but I guess I'm surprised that he has not known this. I mean, he's a registered voter. Did he vote for or against it?
Now, in California, not too long back, they were able to persuade the voters to put a lot of state money,
yep,
toward the possibility or toward funding embryonic stem cell research in that state. And one would expect that after at least this small amount of time, we'd be reaping the benefits with all sorts of cures and progress in that area. What's happened to the, I think it was $3 million that the voters committed themselves to paying for embryonic stem cell research?
No, that would be B with a billion, $3 billion.
Yeah, $3 billion.
$3 billion and $6 to $7 billion after the interest on the bonds is paid off from California voters. You know, what's happened, we've had presidents of the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine come and go. We've had a lot of shakedown in the structure of the setting up of the Institute of Regenerative Medicine, a lot of infighting and a lot of wondering who's getting along with whom. And you know what? No research cures have come out of the $3 billion boondoggle.
Jennifer, finally, it's California, it's New Jersey. Other states have made attempts at this. Missouri, of course, had its Amendment 2 that in some ways, although it didn't deal with the money, dealt with the legality of this. Where is this going as a national issue?
I just think you're going to see cloning coming to a state near you. New York is trying to pass a big cloning initiative in their state. Since we can't get a ban at the federal level, what we're seeing is states hopping on the bandwagon saying we've got to do it here or we're going to lose our cutting edge. All of our best scientists, our biotech is going to flee the state and go somewhere else. Again, listeners, use Google. See what's really happening, and you'll know that this is just pouring money down the drain, not embryos.
And finally, with 30 seconds, what kind of pressure do you think is going to be brought to bear with a change of the presidency in 2008 and of the legislature as well for federal funding for embryonic stem cell research?
Well, I think looking at, you know, the electable candidates, we can probably say it's not going to be terribly good for our side of the cause. That I think the Bush policies may give way under the next White House administration.
Folks, for information on issues bioethical, check out cbc-network.org. It's the website address for the Center for Bioethics and Culture, cbc-network.org. Jennifer Lawls, founder and national director of the Center for Bioethics and Culture. Jennifer, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Folks, Concordia Seminary St. Louis and Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, they are preparing the next generation of pastors. And among the many other things that they are preparing them for is to live in a culture of death and to continue to defend life from beginning to end. Some dark days may lie ahead for those who want to defend life from beginning to end, and pastors need to be prepared to equip their people to do just that. Now, if you've ever considered the vocation of a pastor, check out the website, our website, tonight, issuesetc.org. Look for the logos of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, and Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, issuesetc.org. Well, we're coming to you live this Tuesday, November the 6th. The first hour's up, but in the second hour, we're going to be doing a little bit of audio open lines. This has been bubbling and brewing and slowly coming to a boil, no pun intended, the issue of climate change and global warming among mainline evangelicals. Well, now, Richard Cizik of the National Association of Evangelicals is in the press talking about the climate issue as a moral issue for Christians, as a biblical issue, a mandate from God, and as an issue that he would like to see on equal footing with the other big-ticket item issues that evangelicals often concern themselves with when they go to the polls. Marriage, gay marriage, family values, abortion, those kind of things. He says that climate change and what the church needs to do about it should be on equal footing. We'll hear from him in an interview. Joe Scarborough interviews him, and I want your reaction. Do you think that climate change, regardless of where you think it comes from, do you think that climate change should be given a place at the top of the list for evangelical and values voters? And do you think the church should issue a call to arms and get behind and push on changing global climate change, on recycling, on going green? I mean, after all, everybody else is going green. It's audio open lines after this break, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Email your questions or comments to issuesetc@kfuo.org. And in the last hour of the program, we'll review a sermon by Pastor Joe Fisher of Pilgrim Lutheran Church in West Bend, Wisconsin.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.